The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this morning, what I'd like to talk about is how to evaluate your practice. I think that it's pretty common for people, humans, to be evaluators. We're evaluating things all the time, and a lot of the evaluation goes on subconsciously. For example, you evaluate what clothes you're going to wear depending on the weather or different things. If you get on a bicycle, you evaluate all kinds of things. About some of these are subconscious even, very simply. If you're in the prime of health and capable bicycler, you don't think too much what you're doing, but there is kind of background evaluation that goes on. Am I capable? Perhaps if it's snowing and icy outside, you realize maybe not in those circumstances. When you get to be 98, you evaluate more carefully. Can I still do ride the bicycle? It becomes more important evaluation. But you evaluate a goal you have set for yourself, or where you're going. If you said, well, I'm going to go for a bike ride this morning and go to L.A., it's without any preparation, it's probably a bit over the top. You evaluate your energy level, how you're feeling, how much you've eaten, how prepared you are. There's many things that go into preparation. And some of it, you don't hardly even notice you think about. It's kind of so automatic. But it's there in something as simple as riding a bike, or many things that you do. And so in the same way, I think people evaluate their practice. And sometimes people will do it, again, subconsciously, without really good criteria, without really good understanding of what's reasonable to evaluate in their practice. Meditation practice or their spiritual practice. And sometimes people don't do enough evaluation. They just kind of, maybe they have a lot of faith, or just, I don't know, just kind of dumb. Dumb meditation. this is what I do, and, it's what I do, and I'll just do it, and there's never any kind of evaluation at all about what's happening when you meditate or what's going on, what it's all about. And then some people over-evaluate and tie themselves in knots. So, for example, if you're learning to ride a bicycle for the first time you sit on the seat and push the pedal down, you don't start, am I doing it yet? Look for approval. You don't look around first and see, have you gotten someplace? I mean, you better focus on trying to stay balanced and not evaluating too much what's going on. My favorite over-evaluation story is the story of the farmer who goes out into her field and pulls out little corn seedling out of the ground to see if it's growing yet. And thereby destroying the seedling. And it doesn't grow. So sometimes if we kind of start, there's a way of over-evaluating ourselves that actually can undermine the very attempts of practice we're trying to do. But I think it's, sooner or later, it's important to spend some time evaluating what's going on with your practice so that you can know whether it's working, if it's working well enough, whether it is... need some corrections, need some work, so that you can get some of the full benefits of the practice that maybe only come if there's a stepping back and kind of looking and understanding what's actually happening here. So there are many, I'm going to go through a list of things that you could evaluate if you so choose. You don't have to go through this list systematically like a checklist kind of thing. And they're not necessarily put in the order they should be done. Some of this probably happens kind of automatically or subconsciously or something. But from time to time, some of these different areas of investigation might be useful for you to consider. If you've been practicing for a few years, it might be really good to spend some serious amount of time stepping back, thinking about your practice, what's happened, what's going on for you. If you're brand new, maybe you don't want to spend too much time. You want to actually kind of do it for a while. For people who are come to me, who are interested in doing some kind of meditation practice or Buddhist practice, but they haven't decided what to do yet. There's Tibetan, there's Zen, there's Vipassana, there's all kinds of different choices and different teachers and this and that. And they want to start and they can't decide what. I'll often say, for the first year, it probably doesn't matter what you choose. Just choose something. Flip a coin, do your best guess. Because when you're a new meditator, no matter what tradition you're in, you're dealing with a lot of the same issues. And most of those issues are you, not the tradition. And you're learning yourself, you're learning to be patient, you're learning to be mindful, developing some stability of mind. You may be looking at your ethics, so you kind of start living more ethically. Kind of start doing a kind of a very basic kind of introduction to Buddhist practice. And after a year or so of doing that, then you will have better eyes to discern what tradition fits you. So if you can't decide, wait a year. So sometimes if you're new, you don't want to do a lot of evaluation. You just want to get some experience under your belt. And then with that experience, you can kind of do a better job. Some of this evaluation you can do on your own, and some of it perhaps can be done with a teacher. Because sometimes teachers can ask questions, or it's interesting to explore these with friends or fellow practitioners or with teachers. So the first thing to consider is, what is your motivation in doing the practice? What is your aspiration? A lovely word, I think. Why are you doing it? And there are many answers to that question. I would not want to be in the position of telling you what your goal should be. As a teacher, I like to try to learn from people. When people come to talk to me, I like to understand what their intention is so I can support them in their intention rather than tell them, oh, that's not a good intention, you should do this. But rather, you know, and everybody has will have a little different flavor or taste or kind of way in which their life is going to unfold. And so it's very important to the motivation to rise out of your own heart or your own understanding of yourself. And there are different, so in terms of a spiritual practice, what is your motivation in doing it? I feel, like I've often said, that the intention, our deepest intention, is one of the most important things that we have to discern. And to spend some time contemplating, what is my deepest intention I have for this life of mine, is a really worthwhile thing to do. It's very easy to live a surface life. Society will give us a lot of purposes to pursue, and many of which are not so worthwhile. And so to be able to step back from the socially family-given purposes of our life and really kind of dwell deep inside and find, what do I really want? What's really my heart's wish? Is a very important exercise to do. So if you find your deepest wish, then you can say, well, now, how does my spiritual practice fit into that? Is that deepest wish spiritual or Buddhist or something? Does it have to do with meditation, perhaps? Or does meditation or Buddhist practice support my deepest intention? It makes it easier to fulfill that. If you have a deepest intention that you want your life to be about, and it has no connection to spiritual practice, spiritual practice doesn't even support your deepest intention, then why do it? Why do spiritual practice? Just chuck it, you know, and trust the deepest intention and the clarifying it and staying in touch with it. And for some people, their motivation for practice is well articulated. They have good reasons. They understand why they're doing it. And sometimes it's not articulated. They can't really put words on it. This is why I'm practicing. And I've gone through a variety of phases in my own practice, some which were I knew really well what my purpose was, and some which I didn't know what my purpose was. But I knew I had to sit. I knew I wanted to practice. And I thought it was kind of odd, the phases where I was really motivated to practice, it was really important for me to do, to meditate, to maybe live in monasteries, to do a variety of things. I thought it was really odd that I couldn't actually say why. I just knew it was the right thing. I was just like pulled towards it. And other times when I could say very clearly, there were times when I said, well, I'm suffering, and I'm practicing in order to overcome or be free of my suffering. Sometimes the suffering was conventional psychological suffering. And sometimes it wasn't so much a conventional thing we call suffering, but in situations where my life was basically, you know, conventionally suffering-free, well, happy, there was some clear insight that there was some deep dissatisfaction, some deep uneasiness, or some deep kind of way in which suffering resided somehow at the background or at the cornerstone of the way my mind, heart worked. And it just felt really important to kind of find that and touch it and somehow resolve it. At times, the motivation has been to develop or to touch or awaken, reveal beautiful qualities that exist in the human heart and mind. There's beauty. The heart and mind has these amazing capacities for love, for peace, for courage, for compassion, for insight, for understanding the truth, pursuing the truth. And so sometimes the motivation for me has been to kind of go towards those things, to develop those. And sometimes the motivation for me in my practice has been I practice not for myself, but rather strongly motivated to do the practice to support other people. And I believe that sooner or later, people are not going to keep doing this meditation practice or Buddhist practice if they're only doing it for themselves. So to understand how the practice, your own practice, is supportive for others is one of the reasons to keep practicing. So there's a wide range. Some of the sense of motivation is intuitive. It just seems right. Sometimes it's very well understood. But then there's also short-term and long-term motivations or goals, purposes. You know, if you sit down, you're a new meditator, you sit down to meditate and say, well, in this 45-minute meditation, I'm going to get fully and completely enlightened. Thank you. And it's probably unrealistic. Perhaps for this meditation, the goal is I'm just going to try to strengthen my mind's capacity to be present. I'm going to try to learn how to let go of a lot of the preoccupations that keep me caught up all the time. And as I learn, become more skillful at being really present, the mind is stable here, I get skillful at letting go of things, then perhaps someday I can start moving slowly towards some of the more ambitious goals that I have for myself. It's a step-by-step thing. You don't run a marathon by just running cold, you know. Usually people spend months, years sometimes, preparing for that. So I don't know if marathon is the best analogy for spiritual practice, but there is a sense that, you know, you want to kind of focus sometimes on what's happening right here, and cultivating and developing yourself, and then eventually it grows and develops and you mature into someone who can step into some of the more profound experiences that Buddhism points towards. In looking at one's motivation, part of that important valuation is your motivation, is your aspiration reasonable? So again, long-term, short-term, is it reasonable for you and your circumstances? Given your life, how you live your life, what is a reasonable motivation? What's a reasonable purpose for you? I've known people who have had purposes which weren't reasonable. And I've known people who have shortchanged themselves, who could have had, who felt that they, it wasn't okay to have grand aspirations. Somehow Maybe they discount themselves, they feel like they're not that important, or they're afraid of being in touch with the heart's deepest wish, or they feel like, yes, there's this wonderful possibility of spiritual practice, but not for me. And so, you know, I'm going to be content just to go and read some Dharma book that inspires me and lets me feel like, yes, this is true, and I feel like I'm in touch with something true, but I can't really do this myself. So people hold themselves back and don't give themselves enough motivation sometimes or sense of purpose when they're quite capable. And then connected to the motivation is what's the degree of inspiration you have for that motivation? There's plenty of people who are what's called bookstand Buddhists. And they can have great motivation as they're reading their books. Wow, this Buddhism is great, enlightenment is great, I'm made for this, this is wonderful, yes, I'm going to do this. And then they close their book and and that's the last of it until they open the next book. And some people are a little bit kind of book junkies in Buddhism. They kind of just like to read and get kind of high. Oh yeah, it's great. But they don't really do the work themselves. But you know, how inspired are you? How much motivation, what's the strength of that motivation? Yeah, it's a good idea, but I'm not really going to get off out of the couch. It's a good idea, but I'll get around to it eventually. You know, there's maybe not much discipline to follow through. So there's a whole category of things to look at when we look at the motivation. And this is also a very interesting place to be in conversation with someone else about as well. Sometimes when we talk to someone else about our motivation, we hear ourselves and understand ourselves in a new way. But also the other person can ask questions, offer different perspectives. It can be kind of a check and balance. It can be very useful. The next area of self, of evaluating one's practice, has to do with how well you understand yourself. And perhaps no one understands themselves well enough. So there's always room for more understanding. But how much is there enough self-understanding to know how to match your motivation and practice with who you are? If you read a generic Dharma book that lays out a course of practice, then you might think, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do, A, B, and C. But it might not actually fit for who you are or the phase of that your life is in. There might be issues that you have to deal with that are different than what your teacher is telling you to do. So, for example, I will often give talks, I think, about mindfulness, about meditation, connected to that. But in the last years, I have not given many talks about ethics. And it might be that for some people that working and dealing with their ethics is the most important thing they should be working on, not meditating. And so, you know, if you've kind of listen to me and think you're supposed to be meditating all the time and to try to fit yourself into that mold, then it's maybe a misfit for who you are. There might be particular psychological issues that you have. You might have certain ways in which your brain works. I'm really struck by how different people are from each other and how similar. One of the ways I was so struck by how different was now that I'm raising children, I'm around a lot of children, and to see what a wide range of how different these children are come into the world as. And then probably read in the paper yesterday, some of you, that one in every 110 Americans has autism. I don't know if it's children now or what, I don't know exactly how it is, but it's a very high incidence of autism. And in my circle of my son's friends, there's autistic kids and Asperger kids and lots of kids with so-called learning disabilities and attention deficit disorders, all these wonderful kind of names that are, you know, that diagnoses which are kind of, you know, draining, energy draining to hear. But what I've learned is that to not try not to look at people who have all these differences as being disorders, but rather to see this is who they are, and to try to look at the gift of this person. So if a person has, it's very common these days to say someone has a learning disorder. I prefer to say a learning difference. And because of many different ways of learning. And some people learn more auditorily. Some people learn more visually. See something written really works. Some people learn kinesthetically. Doing something really works best for them. There's many different ways that people learn. And so you understand yourself. How do you learn best? What works best for you? I think it's very important that when you do a spiritual practice to understand yourself enough that you know how to tailor make the practice for who you are without at the same time tailor making it according to your preferences. So that's a trick, that's a very important area. And that's also where it's useful to talk to someone else. Say, this is who I am, this is how things work for me, and so I'm going to practice this way. What do you think? And then a friend or a teacher can say, that's interesting, but it looks to me like you're just attached to pleasure. You're just attached to, something. Or the teacher might say, well, that's great. That seems just right. Given who you are, that seems to be your way. Some people find that reading, studying, is something that really helps them deepen into their spiritual life. Other people find that reading and studying it just becomes intellectual exercise. It's not valuable at all. Some people find that maybe more the extrovert types find that their spiritual life unfolds best if there's a lot of conversation or communication or interchange with other people. There are people who are more introverted who find that their spiritual life works best if they spend a lot of time alone. And that works best. So to understand yourself well enough to know how to adapt the spiritual practice for who you are. Then, the next area of evaluation is understanding what the practice is, the instructions for the practice. And there are people who have strong motivation, who might understand themselves relatively well, but don't actually know what to do. There are some Buddhist traditions that purposely don't teach you very much, don't give a lot of instructions. And some people do well in that system, and some people flounder because they just kind of don't know what they're doing. They spend years. Sometimes people have been years kind of sitting in meditation daydreaming because they weren't ever given any real clear instructions of what to do. Or some people are given instructions in particular areas that are useful in that particular area, but in order to really develop in an all-around way, they need to understand how the instruction applies to other areas. So a person might get a lot of instructions, for example, on mindfulness of breathing, mindfulness of the body, but maybe not to understand how to work with their emotional life. It was one of the great things that happened for me when I came into Vipassana practice is that I had not been told much or given much instruction of how to work with my emotional life before doing Vipassana. And Vipassana, I learned how to turn the attention towards the emotional life and understand it in some deeper way. So there's a whole series of areas of instructions. Here at IMC, we often give instructions in working with the breath, with the body, with emotions, with thinking, with quality or state of the mind, intentions, not just your big intentions, but just all the intentions of your day. To have actually clear instructions how to work with intentions, with attitude, instructions in walking meditation. Instructions in some sense of how to practice in speech, mindfulness of speaking. Do you practice at work? Do you have some sense of instructions or some sense of understanding how to practice in the work that you do? Or do you leave your practice at home and have a kind of a divided life? Do you understand that everything, how everything you do can be your spiritual practice? Or do you have a kind of instructions or understanding of spirituality that divides up the world between that which is so-called spiritual and that which is, you know, not. And so you're happy to practice meditation in Buddhism Sunday morning at IMC, but then you don't think about it until next week, next Sunday. It's really, you know, that the rest of the life, as you know, has other things which really take the forefront. So what is your understanding of practice, the domain of practice, how to do practice? And this also is useful to not only evaluate but discuss with others, because you might have missed something, you might have something a little bit off, you might understand the instructions in and of themselves, but you have not heard the instructions about you've heard the instructions about the practice, the do, but you have not heard the instructions about how to do the practice. And the difference is, someone might tell you, okay, and now the meditation practice is to try to follow your breath. That's the practice. How do you do that practice of following the breath? Well, you could strive and grit your teeth and really push and be demanding, or you could, I'll get around to one of these breaths, one of these, you know, the sitting's just started. You know, we have 35 minutes for this meditation. There's a lot of breaths, you know. I think I'll just, you know, I'll get to it. You know, I have important things to think about or do here. And I think it's about halfway through. I still have some time. I'm getting to the end now. I think now it's probably a good idea to focus on a couple of breaths. You know, kind of can be maybe too complacent or easygoing. So the attitude we have, how we practice, is a very important area of practice itself. And so part of the evaluation is to look, how am I doing it? What's the attitude, what's the approach in which I'm doing this practice? There can be a lot of both subtle and great course adjustments that are needed in the how, the approach we have in doing practice. Are you too ambitious, pushing too hard? Is there too much expectation? Is there not enough patience? Do you understand the importance of patience? Do you understand something about the balance between having a goal in practice and at the same time being goalless, showing up and being really present here without the filter of the goal, without letting the goal trip you up, without missing the possibility of having some profound sense of presence here? That would not be, that the profound sense of presence, or mindfulness, wouldn't be here if we have a goal that has us looking into the future for what I'm going to attain. There has to be, you have to understand something about the balance between being goalless and having a goal. So there's a lot to understand about how to do the practice. And I guess I kind of said it already, but I want to say it again. How well integrated is your practice in the rest of your life? Do you divide the practice? Some areas, you know, are for practice and other areas not. How well is it integrated in the way you live your life? I like this quote by Gary Snyder. All of us are apprenticed to the same teacher that the religious institutions originally worked with, reality. Reality Insight says, master the 24 hours. Do it well without self-pity. It is as hard to get the children herded into the carpool and down the road to the bus as it is to chant sutras in the Buddha hall on a cold morning. One move is not better than the other. Each can be quite boring, and they both have the virtuous quality of repetition. Repetition and ritual and their good results come in many forms. Changing the oil filter, wiping noses, going to meetings, picking up around the house, washing dishes, checking the dipstick. Don't let yourself think these are distracting you from your more serious pursuits. Such a round of chores is not a set of difficulties we hope to escape from so that we may do our practice, which will put us on the path. It is our path. So the next area, I've covered so far are motivation, self-understanding, and understanding the practice itself or the instructions that you're going to do. The fourth area has to do with balance. Is your life balanced? Is your practice balanced? Is there a right balance of activity and non-activity, work and not work, socializing, being with friends and people, and being alone? Is there a right balance? Do you have enough time off to allow for some kind of contemplative time to happen for you? Is there a balance energetically? Do you get enough exercise so that you have a good balanced energy as you kind of go through your life? Without good energy, it's hard to do a spiritual practice. Do you get too much exercise? I have known some people who get too much. And what means too much is that they can't really sit still. They're always kind of charged up. And there's a kind of depending on the charge they always get. You see it occasionally on retreat that kind of exercise junkies, they just can't sit still. They have to kind of, and they come with great arguments about how important it is to run or do something as part of their spiritual practice. And usually when people come with strong arguments for it, that's usually a sign that it's probably imbalanced. Exercise is important, but... And I like the term balance because it points out that we're multidimensional. There's many different aspects to who we are as a human being. And so sometimes we get stuck on it's one way. This one thing is the important thing. And it's often more than one thing. Things have to be in balance. So in terms of meditation practice itself, there's a variety of psychological factors or physical psychological factors that need to come into balance. There's a balance between faith and wisdom, confidence and discernment. There's a balance between having energy and being calm or being concentrated. You need both. You need to have some confidence or faith to do the practice, but you also need to have some wisdom about that faith. There are some people who have blind faith and with not any wisdom. There are people who have a lot of understanding, but they have no confidence or no faith. There are people who have who are too calm, don't have enough energy. And then there's people who can get concentrated and have an adequate amount of energy to balance that concentration. So classically in meditation practice, a meditator is looking at the balance between these factors. And the most important one, I think, is the one between energy and concentration, energy and calm. You have to get wise and kind of swimming, negotiating between those two factors, tracking oneself, and noticing when you get so calm that your mind starts to drift. You need to have a little more aroused energy to match the calm. Not to lose the calm, but to match it. Some people, the interesting balance is between service and self-care. At different phases in people's practice life, it might be more important to do self-care, to practice for yourself, be on retreat. Other phases, it might be very important that you have your practice more outwardly directed, to be of service and to help others. And how do you negotiate the balance between service and self-care? And the balance between practice and study. There are people who practice a lot, but their practice would be supported by more study. So they understand some of the teachings and can grapple with the teachings and use the teachings to be a mirror to understand themselves better. There are people who study too much and do things like get PhDs in Buddhist studies. Yeah. And So, you know, there's all kinds of things you can do, but is there appropriate balance? The next area is what are the problems you have in doing the practice? What are the obstacles you have? And sometimes it's really useful to kind of look at what are the attachments you have? What are the places you get stuck when you do the practice? And there's a whole slew of areas. So one interesting question, for example, is if you're practicing mindfulness throughout the day, when in the day are you most likely to lose it? Are there any patterns behind it? It's easy enough to kind of lose your mindfulness and not think that's important. I'll get around to it eventually. But that might be the cutting edge of your practice is to understand, you mostly lose it, when things get very hectic, or when things have a lot to do with self-image, when you have to go and talk to other people in your work and maybe make a presentation, and you get kind of caught up in self-concern, that's when you lose your mindfulness. Or it might be that, I don't know what, there's all kinds of possibilities. So to study, when do I lose it? Or what are some of the preoccupations that pull you away from being present, being mindful? What are the challenges you have to work through that would be useful to kind of look at more deeply and more carefully? Do you get attached to pleasure, to comfort? Are you aversive to discomfort? And is that an important motivating aspect for your life, an important obstacle for doing the practice? If you're too caught up in pleasure and comfort, it's very hard to practice in an honest way. If you're too aversive to discomfort, it's also difficult to practice. You have to find the right balance of the two. So the right way to hold both of them so that they become part of the path rather than obstacles to the path. What's the role that fear and aversion have for you? What's your relationship to altered states? Sometimes in meditation, people experience altered states. States are different from what they're used to having. And what's your relationship to that? Are you afraid of them? Are you confused by them? Are you strongly attached to them? That's what it's all about. Altered states, that's what it's all about. Nothing else counts. This ordinary mind state that I have, ordinary life, that's not important. It just gets in the way. What's your relationship? Are you stuck around states of mind? Are there problems with your ethics, your sila? Is it becoming an obstacle to you further in your spiritual practice, the fact that your behavior is not really so ethical? I like this little description. A few years ago, at an alcoholism treatment center in the suburbs of Chicago, staff members reported an intriguing discovery. Many of them lived at some distance from the facility, each day braving the hazards of tollway traffic in commuting to and from work. Then one day, the state of Illinois instituted honor system toll collection booths in that area. No attendant, no barrier gate, just a basket into which motorists were expected to throw their coins. Data are unavailable about how well the method served in meeting the highway department's physical and traffic flow needs. But counselors at the treatment center collected observations that soon added up to an axiom. Those who don't throw their money in, their patients don't get well. As one counselor put it in telling the story, how can you pass on an honest program if you aren't honest yourself? Honesty is indivisible. So looking at how you behave and your ethics is an important part of practice. Another interesting problem area that's kind of points to some of the core issues of Buddhist practice, at least, it has to do with how much self is involved when you practice. One of the very intriguing or challenging aspects for some people is to distinguish between the self-observation, self-tracking, the mindfulness, which a big part of mindfulness, especially in meditation, is to look at yourself, understand yourself, where your attachments are, to let go. So there's a kind of a self-focus in a certain kind of way. How do you distinguish that from narcissism? Isn't that interesting? I think it's interesting. More than interesting, I'm perplexed sometimes. It doesn't happen that often, but every once in a while someone comes and talks to me about their practice. And it's reasonable they're talking about their practice. That's usually what people do when they talk to me. That's good. So it's fine. But then I start, at least imagining, I'm scratching my head, tipping my head sideways and looking at them. You know, I wonder, is this person just really narcissistic? And there'll be no end to talking about themselves. They're really, really self-obsessed in a big way. It's all about themselves. They're not practicing to become free of self-attachment. They're practicing as a way of continuing self-attachment. So it's a tricky thing, to find that balance. But to look at, you know, how does self-image come into play when you practice? What is self? What are the expectations around self? What kind of self are you trying to make and create? For who? It's some of the problem areas that can occur in practice. Another area of evaluation is to begin at some point appreciating the understandings and insights that you are that come with a practice. So as you do Buddhist practice, at least, understanding, insight is an important part of it. And so it's not just a matter of, you know, changing, becoming calm, changing your mind state or something, but it's also a matter of understanding how your mind works, how your heart works. What are the causes and conditions that bring together your forms of suffering that you have? What are the causes and conditions that bring liberation from suffering? How does compassion work for you? There's a whole slew of areas to understand. What are some of the things that, as you sit and look more and more deeply, how well do you understand how selfing works? The whole idea of how we create a sense of self, make up a sense of self. We often take the self for granted, as if it's God-given. I don't know. It's just the way it is. That's why I have this self. But Buddhist practice shows you that if you look carefully, much of what we think of as a self is a construct. It's something that's being an activity being created and formed and shaped moment by moment. And if you start looking and seeing the creative aspect of it, you'll start having insight into how that works. So there's a variety of things that begin revealing themselves as we do the practice. And so to begin appreciating those insights, probably the most important one, my guess, the most important insight, understanding to have in our tradition of Buddhism is to understand how clinging works. To understand the nature of grasping and clinging and all its subtle and multifarious ways in which we cling. And then to understand, if you can, understand how you can release that clinging. If you understand those two things and the value of those two things, all of Buddhism will open up for you. So as your practice deepens, you start understanding better and better the nature of clinging, how you cling, what you cling to. There's also insight into some of the beautiful states of mind, states of heart, that can bubble up as we practice. You have insight into how compassion works and the value of compassion, insight into loving kindness, how to develop loving kindness, how to cultivate it. There's a lot of things. And so at some point, being able to appreciate those insight and understanding is very important because that strengthens them and that allows us to build on them and be informed by them as we kind of continue our practice. And here again, it can be very useful to be in conversation with someone else about it, saying, oh, this is my understanding now. I've had this insight, this is how I understand things. One of the reasons to have an interview with a Buddhist teacher is not to go and talk about your problems, your difficulties, but rather to go talk about the understandings and insights you've had in practice. I've been practicing now for a year, 2 years, 10 years, and this is the understanding I've come to in my practice. This is the understanding that I base my practice on. What do you think of that? And the teacher will say, great. Sometimes the teacher is just a glorified cheerleader. And sometimes they'll say, that's interesting. Or something like that. So there's personal insights, the understanding nature of the world better. There's Dharma insights. And then the last area of evaluation is to spend some time evaluating or understanding what the benefits and blessings have been from doing the practice. What are the benefits that you've experienced in doing the practice? It's a little bit different than the insights. Because sooner or later, this Buddhist practice is supposed to bring benefits. Sometimes it's later. We have to be patient. But sometimes it's immediate. And sometimes it's both. My ideal idea of someone's practice is that they would see the immediate benefits of one moment of mindfulness and feel like one moment of mindfulness is satisfying and meaningful in and of itself because it's so beneficial. And they would have some sense of how the mindfulness practice is onward leading to a deeper and deeper realization of freedom. So both exist together. But, there's all kinds of benefits to be had. You can be calmer. You go about your life more understanding, less reactive. Don't cause as much problems anymore for yourself as you go about your life. Don't cause so many problems for other people anymore. They're really glad for the benefits. There's a greater sense of joy, delight in just being alive, being present, feeling lighter, more at ease with how things are. There is greater capacity for courage, for doing difficult things, to really, when you're really challenged by something, have the ability to hang in there and see it to the end, kind of a great resolve. Having resolve, strong resolve is a benefit. One of the benefits is how we can be of greater help to our community, help support other people better from having done the practice. And some of these benefits are blessings. We realize how much blessing there is in this life of ours, how much fortune there is. I think just to be alive is to be fortunate. And there's so much that supports our lives. And I think part of the value of the practice is to appreciate how much support we have, to feel the gratitude for that and the value of that. And part of the reason to appreciate the benefits and blessings is that as we appreciate and recognize something, it tends to strengthen it. We tend to notice it more fully. We tend to notice it more often. And as we notice something, it becomes more part of who we are. There's a lot of so-called blessings, fortunate things that we receive. It's all kinds of things that I don't spend much time reflecting on how wonderful it is that I'm the recipient of these blessings. But for example, I don't often think about how lucky I am to have an electrical system that works. It's a pretty amazing thing that we have this all electricity that comes our way. And when I think about that, it kind of lightens my heart. I feel kind of nice. So I'll end by saying that from time to time, it's useful to evaluate your practice. Sometimes you do small evaluations as you go along. And so for example, if you're sleepy, when you sit down to meditate, you evaluate, you're aware of that sleepiness, you know the instructions of what to do when you're sleepy, and you do it. You sit up straighter, you open your eyes when you meditate. That's a simple evaluation. Sometimes you want to step back and maybe go for a day and walk on the beach, or take a journal, you know, a book with you and write on it, and really reflect, you know, what is it my life is about? When I turned 50, I went for a five-day hike in the Sierras by myself. And part of the purpose for that was to kind of review my life and to see what was my intention, my aspiration, what did I want my life to be about now that this, you know, this turning point of 50. So I spent 5 days kind of walking in the Sierras and kind of reflecting and thinking. It was very useful. So sometimes small evaluations, sometimes big evaluations. And as you look at all this, your motivation, yourself, your benefits, one thing that I encourage you to do is to give a lot of credence, a lot of value to your beauty, to your nobility, to your capacity for good, for freedom. Every heart has a tremendous amount of beauty in it. Potential beauty, capacity for beauty, capacity for... And some people are much more hesitant to appreciate their own beauty and to act on it as if it's very important than they are to appreciate their neurosis. And it's certainly important to bring mindfulness to your neurosis if you're neurotic. But perhaps your neurosis would be seen in a very different context if you saw it in the context of your profound capacity for beauty. And may your particular beauty flower and grow and become a gift for others. So thank you.